But turning to today again, now we always, as you know, try to be topical, and I think one of the areas of major interest at the moment in terms of the future stability, not only of that region but also of the world, is that area of Yemen and Somalia. Today we're very lucky, we have three eminent speakers, and I'm going to introduce them now and then call them each to speak in turn for 10 minutes, after which I will give them 5 minutes to use between themselves if they have any points they want to raise with each other, and then as usual I'll open it to the floor. First we've got Victoria Clark on my right. She's a former correspondent and Moscow bureau chief of The Observer. She now works as a freelance journalist and writer, contributing to The Times, The Independent, the BBC and Prospect magazine. She's the author of Yemen, Dancing on the Heads of Snakes, a book which is on sale at the back of the room on your way out, and I'm sure if you ask her to, she will sign copies of it if you wish to buy one. Then on my left, I've got Stephen Day, CMG, who served for 7 years as political officer in the Western Aden Protectorate. During the last 6 months of its existence, he sat as a British advisor on the cabinet of the doomed federal government of Saudi Arabia. He then joined the diplomatic service and went on to be appointed deputy head and later head of the Middle East Department, ambassador to Qatar and Tunisia, and senior trade commissioner in Hong Kong. And so, again, we have somebody with a great deal of experience to talk to us today. On my far right, we have Dr. Christian Coates-Ulrichsen, who is a research fellow at the LSE Global Governance and deputy director of the Kuwait Research Programme on Development, Governance and Globalisation in the Gulf States, a post he's held since March 2008. His main area of research focuses on the evolution of political and security trends in the Arabian Peninsula and the emergence of longer-term and non-military challenges to regional stability in the GCC. He's an author of many works, and I'm not going to read them all because there are so many, but I'm sure we'll look forward to hearing him as well. I'm going to start then by asking Victoria Clark if she will lead off today on the question I've set of Yemen and Somalia, a ticking time bomb.
Thank you very much. Well, I think Yemen and the words ticking time bomb go together like a horse and carriage, or Charles and Camilla. These days, everybody knows that Yemen is the new place to focus on. And it's not only from the point of view of Al-Qaeda, of course. Yemen is facing a number of huge crises that are sort of unimaginable, to think that this country is still going along, facing the fact that Sana'a, the capital, may run out of water by 2017. The oil is likely to run out. They haven't got that much, but it's also likely to run out by 2017. The population is exploding. The average number of children for each woman is 6. It's just everywhere you look, you think, oh no, not another catastrophe in the offing. So that is really makes Yemen a ticking time bomb from at least 5 different angles. But of course, everybody knows that the West is interested in Yemen in as much as it shows signs of being able to shape up into a sort of playground for Al-Qaeda, a homeland, because it's got everything that jihadists could want, namely chaos, really, and a lot of unemployed young people. Yemen suddenly vaulted into the news just when I thought I was publishing a book that nobody would dream of reading and that it would sink without trace before it even appeared. Suddenly, the Christmas Day attempt to bring down an aeroplane over Detroit by a young Nigerian, he was found to have acquired his exploding underpants, let's say, in Yemen. The technology was Yemeni made. So suddenly, all eyes on Yemen. And newspaper reports and people talking about, well, how did we overlook this place? It's quite obvious that it's been Al-Qaeda sanctuary for ages. And all the things that first made me want to look at this, my homeland, my birthplace, rather. I was born in Aden in 1961. Came to the fore. I was thinking about it struck me then, back in 2004 when I started, that Bin Laden's father comes from an area of Yemen, the eastern area of Yemen, which was the Eastern Aden Protectorate under British rule. So that was one thing. And so this is Bin Laden's ancestral home, and that means something in a country so governed by tribal mores. People looked into their databases and found that there's supposed to be 3 guns for every Yemeni in the country, and that's pretty horrific as well. And then people remembered that the USS Cole was the first really big... the bombing of the USS Cole in Aden Harbor was the first really big al-Qaeda action in the year 2000. In 1998, the attacks on the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, both achieved with Yemeni weapons and with Yemeni communications working. So the Yemen, how come we've overlooked this place? Obvious that it's extremely important. We're supposed to be allied with Yemen, but the president has clearly not been a very reliable ally, in that he's arrested dozens of jihadist types, but they kind of go in and out of jail, popping in and out of a revolving door sort of thing. Very, very infuriating for the US, which wants these people locked up, of course. This again makes Yemen extremely attractive for jihadists, if that's the kind of treatment they get. And then there's also this reputation that Yemen has in the Arab world as particularly pure when it comes to Islam. Very beloved by God. Muhammad was also always, did say, faith is of Yemen, wisdom is of Yemen. So it has a sort of rather high moral tone, Yemen, in the Arab world. I mean, realistically, people know that this is a very poor country breeding jihadists, but when they want to get idealistic, they think about its place in God's eyes. And also, then, for example, I found this in Al-Quds al-Arabi in 2004. You had Bin Laden's chief of bodyguard pointing out clearly, it can be said that the majority of Al-Qaeda members are Yemenis. This is a fact no one can deny. The leader of Al-Qaeda is of Yemeni origin. The bodyguards are Yemenis. The trainers in the camps are Yemenis. The commanders at the fronts are Yemenis. All the operations that were directed against the United States were coordinated with Yemeni members. Yemenis are spread all over Al-Qaeda. Well, he was slightly over egging the pudding, I think. But it's true that Yemenis, and especially Yemenis of Saudi origin, Saudis of Yemeni origins, so Yemenis who left their country, gone to live in Saudi, like Bin Laden's family, are the absolute core of Al-Qaeda in its first emanation, whatever. So it really does look as though, yes, we can say Yemen is a ticking time bomb. Any minute now, we can expect Al-Qaeda to be taking over there. Well, actually, I'm going to argue against this. Having started work on this book saying all that, the longer I spent in Yemen, the more I got to know the place, the less convinced I was, actually, that this is a typical Al-Qaeda haven and that it's really the most hospitable place you can imagine. I don't think it is. As I went through the history, again and again, there were instances of Yemeni tribes making it quite clear that they were not amenable to ideological arguments. They were very, very flexible, very, very pragmatic. They loved fighting, admittedly, but they weren't that keen on religion, actually. And what they were keen on was defending their land, getting more land, and money. Simple as that. You read about Yemen in the civil war in 1962. Very, very hard-nosed. Not amenable to ideological arguments of any sort. So from that point of view, I don't... If Al-Qaeda can spare an awful lot of money to keep the Yemeni tribes sweet, then they may succeed for a while. But in the long term, this is not... Al-Qaeda and religion does not float the average Yemeni tribesman's boat. That is not that appealing. Also, I think in the 5 years that I was working, it became clear that the country is actually failing, that the project of building the nation of Yemen is failing. The president has done a fantastically good traditional Arab leader's job of, as he puts it, dancing on the heads of snakes, i.e. keeping everyone happy, reconciling, bribing, cajoling, compromising, flattering, and so forth. He's done that brilliantly for 30 years. But in order to do that convincingly, you do need money. And with this looming oil dwindling crisis, everybody knows that the money is running out, and he's not going to be able to do that. And I think this is one of the reasons why we've seen two major insurgencies in this country, which have put the fight against Al-Qaeda, if it's anywhere at all, right to the back of the agenda. Because the main problem there is that the unification of the country in 1990 has not been a success. South Yemen and North Yemen do not go together like a horse and carriage at all. South Yemen had 123, I think it was, years under British rule, followed by 23 or 25, I think it was, under communist rule, whereas the North had a very, very isolationist theocracy going on for a long time until 1962, and then this republic. So they've really had such different histories, and they just don't get on. So that is really the main drama of the country. And I think that even if it falls apart and appears to be making a vacuum ready for Al-Qaeda to step into, what I've said about the tribes and their priorities make it clear to me that I just don't see this being an easy ride for Al-Qaeda. They'd be foolish, as any other country that tried to, any other power that tried to take over Yemen found throughout history, they'd be very foolish to try it. It's not going to work. Thank you very much. I hope I haven't gone over my time.
Absolutely perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. Stephen Berry.
Summarising Yemen in 10 minutes is a formidable task, so I won't even attempt to stray into Somalia, and I hope our third speaker can say something about that. I declare my interest. I like Yemenis. I've been involved with them all my adult life in one way or another. I found them extraordinarily trustworthy, and I have great respect for their independence of spirit and their physical courage. And there's no doubt, I have the advantage of speaking after Victoria, that the problems they face are pretty horrendous, of unemployment, of poverty, of lack of water, you name it. I remember talking to the Minister of Health of Yemen, who gave some figures for the amount of money spent on health per capita. And I forget what the figures were, but they were something like $1,400 in America, $800 per head in Germany, $600 a head in Britain. That was in the old days. It would have been a lot more now. And $2 a head in Yemen. And he had to try and cope with all the issues there, including a birth control problem, to try and limit the soaring population, which was making the problem so much worse. It's a part of the world for which Britain has a peculiar responsibility. We were there, I think, for 130 years. I wouldn't suggest we ran it. I was responsible for a very large chunk of it for 7 years, but I never had an illusion that I ran it. But we didn't do badly, and whatever happened in 1967 was the result of British policy, and not through any liberation movement in Yemen itself. We decided, for reasons of imminent bankruptcy, that we no longer needed the base. We tore up our treaties. We left. We reneged on all our promises. The people who worked for us were either killed, driven into exile, or went into prison, some of them for 20 years. Until 1994, when the country was more firmly united after its third civil war. The amount of suffering, the amount of human suffering in Yemen is horrendous. And I think that is my approach to the issue of Al-Qaeda. We talk a lot about Afghanistan and a lot about Iraq, and we talk about the British soldiers who've been killed, and that's clearly important to us. But it's very rare that we take account of the number of the locals who have been killed and the lives that have been destroyed. And Britain does have a responsibility there, and I think it's actually in a pretty good position to do something, first of all from our neutrality, and secondly because DFID, since the change of government and under Clare Short, instituted a major aid program which has had not only a significant effect in tackling vast problems, but has created a fund of knowledge about the country which had otherwise disappeared. Britain had two colonies in the Arab world, Palestine and Aden. It bears a heavy responsibility for fouling up both of them. One of them, there have been millions of man-hours spent on trying to resolve the issues that we left behind. The other one was completely ignored for reasons which have always mystified me. But if they were ignored in Britain, they were certainly not ignored in the Arab world. And throughout my diplomatic career, Yemen was a major topic of discussion. I was in the Gulf only last week. It was the number one topic of discussion in the Gulf. When the Prime Minister of Qatar went to see Hillary Clinton about 5 weeks ago, they gave a press conference. Yemen was the number one issue. Iran was number two, and Palestine was number three. And the reasons for that go deep into the past, into the cultural homogeneity of Arabia, all of which culturally was Yemen. The first map of John Speed, published in 1626 in London of the Ottoman Empire, showed Yemen as Arabia, meaning, of course, the place on the right. In the same way as Maghreb was the place on the left, became turned into Morocco, an entity with borders largely influenced by imperial expansion, so the borders of Arabia are relatively modern constructs. So the Yemeni people are found in very large numbers. They were the largest Arab population in Britain, I think, for about 100 years. Very well behaved, very hard working, almost never caused problems. In the Gulf, they are in large numbers in the security forces, in the airports and in the police, and are very important to particularly Doha and Abu Dhabi. The issue is not, is it a problem? It is a problem. What can we do about it? And my overriding conviction is the first thing is stop making it worse. The issue is not the ticking time bomb of Yemen, but the bombs that are actually being dropped in Yemen and are undoubtedly making a bad situation worse. Because the president has many enemies. His policy, as Victoria mentioned, no longer works. The people in the south, who I have the closest contacts with, have been seething with anger and resentment for years. The president has now lost his alliances in the south. He has lost control of the south. This is a tribal territory. The northerners cannot suppress it. We didn't suppress it. We had the largest military base anywhere in the world in Aden. And we failed in the campaign of the Redfern to suppress it by military force. I was appalled over Christmas to read that bombs had been dropped, no one knows by whom, on a village in the territory for which I was responsible, and it wiped out the village. They claimed to have killed 17 Al-Qaeda. The governor, appointed by Sana, admitted that they had also killed 45 innocent people. That was a godsend to Al-Qaeda, who spread out recruiting volunteers to get revenge. And in a tribal territory, that works. So Al-Qaeda, which is not only tiny in Yemeni terms, which is the least of Yemen's problems, indeed, many would argue that it's an asset for the president because the attempt in Detroit has resulted in a doubling of aid, most of it military, and a high degree of international attention. That seems to me absolutely the worst thing that can be done. If we are not going to repeat the problems of the rest of that part of the world, don't intervene militarily and don't give more military aid to a country that is sinking under the weight of armaments. I'm told you not only three rifles a head, well, Kalashnikovs now, But you can buy a tank in Sana'a. They do not need military aid. They need more of what the British government has instituted, which is an attempt to try and cobble together some sort of international consensus. It will be peculiarly difficult because the Gulf countries do not agree on Yemen. There are deep differences between them on how Yemen should be handled. There's a consensus that economic aid is needed and some sort of rapprochement with the GCC. The problem is how to spend the money and make sure it actually gets to the point it's intended for and is not seized along the way. And that is an issue where I find there's a general view that Britain has a peculiarly influential position vis-à-vis the United States, which is the principal concern, the principal threat, and among the Gulf countries themselves. And when I read that the Prime Minister had launched an initiative on it, for whatever reason that may have been, that has launched a process which offers, I think, the only glimmer of hope in an otherwise very bleak situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now, finally, Dr. Ulrichsen.
Well, thanks very much. I'm studying Gulf security issues, and it seems to me that Yemen is experiencing now what the Gulf states will experience over the course of the next century, but at the same time, these are problems of resource depletion, as we've said, rampant demographic growth, environmental degradation and unregulated extraction of water, for example, and fundamentally how to renegotiate a social contract when the resources necessary to underpin that no longer exist. So from the point of view of the Gulf states, Yemen is a deeply interesting and disturbing case study of a perfect storm almost of how these issues feed off each other and act as multipliers. And so for that reason, I'll argue now that Yemen is the most important problem, challenge facing the Gulf states, facing Gulf security, not least because of the interlocking nature of its problems, any one of which would be serious enough, but because it directly links Gulf security to the Horn of Africa and the wider regional tensions and sources of insecurity, and risks bringing in the regionalization of these hitherto localized conflicts and posing a direct threat to the internal security and external stability of the Gulf Cooperation Council. There's also, as the two speakers have said, a human security dimension in Yemen itself, resulting from the flow of Somali refugees, hundreds of thousands, to Yemen, which are adding to the already great strain on scarce resources and the lack of state capacity. Picking up on what Stephen Day said at the end, though, there's a divergence between needs and actions on the part of the GCC, which the primary difficulty lies in getting the GCC to conceptualize the problem as an interlocking problem and to play a coordinated role in tackling these issues. And, I mean, they're facing the reconstitution of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which reformed in January 2009 following the merger of its Saudi and Yemeni wings. And this confirmed the fears of many security officials in the region that the apparent success, the apparent operational and tactical defeat of the earlier incarnation of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula had merely resulted in shifting the problem to the periphery and not dealing with the root causes. And this emerging threat to the Gulf states was underlined in 2008 by the uncovering of numerous plots and plans by Yemeni-led cells, especially one that was targeting a Saudi Arabian oil processing facility in the eastern province, reminiscent of the February 2006 attack on the Abqaiq oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, in 2009, there were several high-profile events which first regionalized the conflict and then internationalized it. I'll just say a few words about them, because from a regional perspective, they're very important. An early indication of this growing transnationalization of the problem and the linkages between Yemen and Somalia came in March 2009 when a Yemeni suicide bomber, killed four South Korean tourists at the World Heritage Site of Shibam. And it emerged that he had actually travelled to Somalia and trained in an al-Qaeda, in an al-Shabaab camp there before returning to Yemen to carry out his attack. And general flows of militants and weaponry flowed between Somalia and Yemen throughout the year. And in December last year, it led the Somali Deputy Defence Minister to actually accuse Yemeni fighters of sending two boatloads to Somalia, quote, with the intention of fueling the flames in a country still already burning. So this brings the regional dimension very firmly into the kind of Gulf security equation and vice versa. And the problems emanating from this turbulent region, Yemen-Somalia, became very visible to the Gulf in August last year when we had the attempted assassination of Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the Deputy Interior Minister of Saudi Arabia, and at the beginning of the border conflict between Saudi Arabia and the Houthi, which began in November. And the attack on Prince Mohammed was significant on several levels. It provided a reminder, a very visible reminder, of the resurgence of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which demonstrated its intent, and on this occasion, its capability of actually penetrating and striking at the heart of the Saudi apparatus. It also highlighted the threat to the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia in particular, from militant infiltration and weapons smuggling, and the targeting of a high-profile member of the ruling family, and the architect, no less, of Saudi Arabia's counter-terror policy, departed from the previous al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula strategy of actually targeting Western symbols and oil installations. It kind of went for the actual regime this time instead. And of course, the situation became militarized in November with the launch of a three-month-long campaign, air and ground campaign by Saudi forces against the Houthi, after rebels crossed the boundary and seized outposts and villages. It led to more than 100 Saudi dead and over about 500 wounded, and took 3 months to quell. And both Saudi and Yemeni officials, interestingly, sought to frame the conflict with the Houthi as part of this discourse of a regional confrontation for influence with Iran, although there's no real substantive evidence of that. But it was a way of increasing Saudi and GCC support for the regime, the government of Ali Abdullah Saleh, which, of course, the events of Christmas Day then accelerated by framing the issue of Yemen as a counter-terrorist issue. And it was this failed bombing of the jet which really catapulted the issue of transnational terrorism emanating from Yemen up the international agenda. It took American officials by surprise. I don't think they had expected that al-Qaeda in Yemen had the capability to actually launch a kind of attack of this kind. So the London meeting was therefore a beginning of a new process, and it could allow the GCC to take the lead if they possess the capacity to do so. And I'd just like to end this brief presentation by just focusing on the GCC for a few minutes, what we might expect from them, what might be realistic and what might not be realistic. And as far back as the 2006 donor meeting in London, the GCC states provided about 60% of the $5.5 billion of aid. They provided about $3.7 billion. But capacity constraints in Yemen and concerns about corruption have meant that only a fraction of that has actually trickled down. And Saudi Arabia led the way with $1.25 billion of aid. And Saudi Arabia also channels money informally to bolster Yemeni military and security institutions and to buy the loyalties of key tribal groups within Yemen itself. But echoing Stephen, on 4 trips to the GCC in 2008 and 2009, and then again on my last trip to the Gulf last week, this time to Kuwait, I found a general unwillingness to really address the root causes, to kind of get to grips with the complexity of Yemen's problems in a comprehensive manner, and a marked preference for hard security responses, such as building the elaborate border defences that Saudi Arabia is doing, or bombing the air and ground campaign against the Houthi. This kind of attitude that, in the words of a former Secretary General of the GCC I spoke to, the GCC is an island of stability in a sea of instability, and it has to be kind of protected against all the various hotspots around it, Yemen, Iraq, Iran, further away, Pakistan, for example. So there's also this lack of internal consensus within the GCC itself for political, for historical reasons. The GCC lacks a collective policy-making framework, which hampers also its dealings with Iran. So it's not a Yemeni-specific thing. there are also very different policies, kind of approaches toward dealing with Yemen. And so with the London summit and the follow-up meeting in Riyadh at the end of February, there is signs that there is a greater willingness on the part of donors and the GCC to begin to kind of channel aid to Yemen. But briefly, just to end by focusing on what the GCC might do or might not do. And the primary difficulty from a Gulf state point of view is to how to provide greater substantive political and economic assistance without linking it to GCC admission, to Yemeni admission to the GCC. This is, for them, it's unrealistic to expect in the near future, although in the more distant future it could at some point be used as an example of a greater leverage over Yemen if they could link possible entry or entry at some level to greater make it contingent on tougher steps, for example, addressing corruption, trying to resolve the political disputes within Yemen. This could be a lever of greater GCC influence in the near future, in the medium future. It's also unreasonable to expect the GCC states to open up their labour markets to Yemeni migrant labourers, however desirable this might seem to some in the international community. I think we've got to recognise that such a move would run counter to 3 decades of Gulf state policies to depoliticise and thoroughly control their workforces. It would leave the GCC states vulnerable to a politicisation of their labourers and reawaken memories of the 1950s and 60s when Egyptian, Palestinian and Yemeni workers were lightning belts of a political opposition to the Arabian Gulf monarchies. So just to end then, the overlapping linkages between Yemen and the Horn of Africa, they necessitate a reassessment of policy on the part of the Gulf states and a recognition that a failing political economy on their commercially and strategically vital southwestern flank presents a multifaceted danger to their internal security and external stability. It requires the GCC to acknowledge that a strategy of containment through hard military measures is no longer a viable option, if it ever was. And it requires them to construct a nuanced and collective policy-making framework which is targeted and doesn't just consist on channeling extra money to the regime, which is much as a part of the problem as a solution, and to address the totality of Yemen's problems rather than focusing merely on the counter-terror dimension. And anything less would be nothing more than a temporary stopgap that would carry the risk of exacerbating the problems in Yemen, the tensions in the fault lines, and making it worse in the long run. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all our panellists for the discipline they've exercised in talking within their time limits. It's quite clear we haven't got any politicians on the platform, otherwise I'd have more difficulty chairing this particular meeting. I'm going to ask each of the panellists whether they want to raise anything which has been raised by the other panellists before I open it to the floor. Do you have any comments you'd like to make?
Could I just add a comment that I'd meant to mention and forgot? Douglas Alexander, the Secretary of State for International Development, made an interesting speech, I think last May, on the role of DFID in trying to avoid the emergence of more failed states. It was a very thoughtful and important speech, and a number of us picked that up and said, well, here's Yemen, here's a real hard nut to get involved in. You're involved there, you know a lot about it. And that led to a long discussion. One of the things that emerged out of it involved Chatham House in trying to establish a core of knowledge. That struck me as a new initiative in Whitehall, that you actually try and understand the issue before you come up with a solution. And given the lack of knowledge of Yemen, partly historical, partly it wasn't sexy enough, it wasn't important enough, partly because of Saudi funding, Saudis don't encourage study of that part of the world. The British knowledge of Yemen, which was very considerable when I was a new entrant in the Foreign Office under Bob Sargent in Cambridge, who's the world expert on the country, that had largely gone. But France had invested a lot in study, other European countries had, and Americans in particular, academics. There's an excellent paper came out in last week in the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace by my namesake, which I think is the sort of quality of academic input that is needed to be marshalled together
And Chatham House had been ready to launch that study, and thanks to the guy over Detroit, brought Yemen into focus, so the government seized on it and funded it. And that is a long-term study to try and marshal knowledge and encourage research on Yemen and a better understanding of these very complex issues which come together to create a very worrying situation. And the idea of studying it first and coming up with solutions later, I think, is fundamental.
Thank you. Do either of you want to make a comment at this stage?
I'd just like to know whether one of the things about Yemen is that it's got huge diaspora communities in the Gulf and especially Saudi. And I'm just wondering if either of the other panelists can say anything about how much influence these diaspora communities, especially in the Gulf countries, can have over what's happening now in Yemen and what's likely to happen in the near future, the succession.
I'll just say one of the priorities for the Chatham House study is that issue, the diaspora. They are very different diaspora. In Saudi Arabia, they are at the top. They are many of the, quite a large proportion of the major Saudi businessmen and bankers are Hadhrami, Saudi by origin, bin Laden's obviously being one of them. Very international, still very attached to their homeland. And at the bottom, North Yemenis, who are labourers, Zaydis. In the Gulf, it's a very different position. In Qatar and UAE in particular, they are tribally recruited. The largest Sunni tribe of Yemen, the Yafa, form a very large proportion of the population of the police in Doha and Abu Dhabi, and they were brought there tribally. They have honorary tribal status, and they discipline themselves impeccably. On the argument that if one of them steps out of line, then the tribe has to fix him. And since that tribe has roots all over the world, in Singapore, in Brunei, in New York, in Chicago, and in London, and in Sheffield, then that so far has worked remarkably well. It doesn't work in Kuwait or Bahrain. And in Oman, there's a very different situation where the Sultan himself, who is acutely conscious of the importance of Yemen and the need to keep his border quiet, manages his affairs in a rather different way. But interestingly, in a meeting in the Gulf of some of the expatriates talking about this, they do not try and exercise influence locally, in my experience, either in Saudi Arabia or in the Gulf. But the person that they regarded as the most likely to mediate within the GCC was Sultan Qaboos, who is hugely respected in Yemen and has that position of authority and separation from the issues between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, which run so deep.
Do you want to comment on that?
Just to say that, for example, in Saudi Arabia, in the southern provinces, for example, in Asir and Najran, there are many, as you know, tribal and cultural and social links with the North Yemenis. Yeah. And this could be a source of strength or source of weakness, depending on how it plays out. And if, for example, in Saudi Arabia, it gets caught up in the politics of uneven development, these areas are among the more marginalized within Saudi Arabia, then it could be a transmission belt of potential discontent into Saudi Arabia in the future.